listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
I look at it this way. Bruce, always telling a lie. He's lived a lie his whole life about who he is. And I can't do that any longer.
Are you a woman?
Yes, for all intents and purposes, I am a woman. People look at me differently. They see you as this macho male. But my heart and my soul and everything that I do in life, it is part of me. That female side is part of me. That's who I am. I was not genetically born that way. As of now, I have all the male parts and all that kind of stuff. So in a lot of ways, we're different, okay? But we still identify as female.
That's Bruce Jenner's 2015 interview with ABC News' Diane Sawyer. When someone says, and it's so common now for someone to say, I was born in the wrong body, in essence, why does that sound reasonable to us? Does it have something to do with the fact that we have located ourselves, our identity, entirely within ourselves? Nothing external, not even our bodies, can say who we are? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Wednesday afternoon, the 17th of February. Dr. Carl Truman joins us to talk about the origins of the sexual revolution. He's a professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College and author of several books, including his latest, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Dr. Truman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
You say that the sexual revolution and the current LGBTQ plus movement, they're only a symptom of a greater and much older revolution in selfhood. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, when you think about it, the sexual revolution seems to have moved very, very quickly through our society. Even in 2015, when gay marriage was being decided by the Supreme Court, already trans ideology was carrying all before it. And those are telltale signs that what's going on is not something that's caused itself, so to speak, but actually rests upon deep social and cultural transformations that have taken place over several hundred years. And what I mean by the revolution of the self that lies behind the sexual revolution is that the way we've come to think of ourselves, the way we've come to think of identity, has turned inward over the centuries. We now think of our desires, our psychology, as fundamentally defining who we are. And that really paves the way for sexual identity, for defining ourselves in terms of our sexual desires, for example. So although the sexual revolution is the most striking aspect of the revolution of the self, the really interesting story is about how we moved inward in order to define what it means to be a human being and what it means to be an individual.
When we say sexual revolution, what are we talking about?
Historically, we're talking about the dramatic transformation in sexual practices and sexual morality that's taken place over the last 50, 60 years, really since the 1960s. Now, the sexual revolution has not particularly inaugurated a new era of how people behave sexually. There's always been adultery. There's always been homosexuality. These things have always existed throughout human history. What the sexual revolution does, what makes it interesting, is that it's not so much an introduction of new sets of sexual behavior as a complete overthrowing of the traditional moral register by which these behaviors are understood, such that, you know, adultery, okay, it happened in the times past, but was always regarded as a vicious, bad thing that damaged human society and human flourishing. Today, sexual promiscuity, adultery, these things are not seen as harmful anymore. Same with homosexuality. Once upon a time, it would be regarded as sinful. Now, it's actually sinful to regard homosexuality as sinful. So the sexual revolution is really a complete overthrowing of the traditional sexual mores of the West.
How should we understand the concept of the self? As you say, it's the air we breathe. how is it currently understood?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And you know, when we talk about the self, there's a common sense way in which we use the term, in that, you know, I know I'm not Todd, you know you're not me. We all have a self-consciousness that we'll sometimes talk about as the self. In the book, I mean something a little different. I mean that which gives me my identity. And as I said, you know, in answer to an earlier question, what we do in the West today is we tend to think that our feelings, our desires, they are the most fundamental things about who we are. It's why, for example, we'll now talk about the LGBTQ movement. When you think about those letters, those are people defining themselves by their desires. So that's what I mean in the book, and I think we're all subject to it to some level. We might like to think, well, that's them, that's the LGBTQ, it isn't me. Think about how you think of yourself. Quite often you think of yourself in terms of your inner psychological states, whether you feel happy, how you feel about life. That inner space has become very authoritative.
So introduce us to the current philosophers of the self.
Well, one very influential figure in the United States of America would be Peter Singer at Princeton. He's professor of ethics at Princeton University. He's actually an Australian by background. He's been in America for very many years, and he's famous for his positions on abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia. He believes that not only should abortion be on demand up to the point of delivery, but actually we should be able to euthanize children up to the age of about 2 years. Well, why does he argue that? It all comes down to his understanding of the self. If the newborn child is going to be a hindrance to the happiness of the parents, to their inner sense of well-being, then the child can be disposed of. The child can be euthanized. You might say, well, but aren't you destroying life then? And Singer would say, yes, but you're not actually destroying a self. You're not actually destroying a person. A newborn child has no sense of the future, has no sense of his own inner sense of psychological happiness. The newborn child may be a living being, but it's not a person. Is not a self. So I would say Peter Singer would be one of the most significant figures, certainly in North America today, with this view of the self as the self-conscious being that needs to be psychologically happy. It's having an effect, of course, on debates about abortion and euthanasia.
Why is Jean-Jacques Rousseau important for understanding the origins of the revolution of selfhood?
Yeah, he was the figure that I start the narrative in my book with. And of course, I could have. One of the problems with the history book is wherever you start, you could always have started a few years before that, because nobody ever emerges out of nowhere. But Rousseau is a significant figure because he's very representative of a move that takes place in the 17th and then the 18th century that sees our feelings as being central to who we are, and also sees those feelings as being corrupted, shaped, perverted by the society around us. So with Rousseau, you really get the birth of the idea of the authentic human being as the one who expresses outwardly that which they feel inwardly. Jump to the present and think, say, about Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner's interview with Diane Sawyer in 2015, when Bruce Jenner is just about to transition to being Caitlyn. And the language he uses in that interview is, all my life I've lived a lie. All my life I've been having to play a part that society wanted me to play. Now I'm actually going to be free to be myself. That's very much the Rousseau register of language about the selfhood, that authorizing of inner feelings over outward reality. We see it in education as well, child-centered education. One of the men who is most influential on the beginning of the trajectory to child-centered education is Rousseau, for whom education is not so much about forming the child into that which society needs, as it is about allowing the child to grow as himself, to perform as himself, and that's the best way of producing a good citizen. So Rousseau is critical in the intellectual genealogy of the modern notion of the selfhood.
Is it any coincidence that Rousseau, in his time, also exercised perhaps unintentional influence over the French Revolution?
Not at all. I think it's very interesting, Rousseau's connection to the French Revolution. Of course, he died before the French Revolution. He never lived to see that, but he was the inspirational philosopher of that. And his confidence that the mass of people could find the sort of the common voice of nature to which everybody should then be made to conform goes a long way to explaining the bloodshed of the Great Terror. So, yes, if you were to compare the American Revolution, which is a comparatively, it's not bloodless, but it's a comparatively bloodless revolution compared to the French one. It's interesting that in America, one of the leading philosophical guides for the American Revolution would be the thought of John Locke, who has a very, very different and far more tolerant approach to the makeup of society than Rousseau. So yes, Rousseau's connection to the French Revolution, I think, is extremely important.
What do you mean by the psychologizing of the self?
Again, it goes back to really that tendency I've been noting from Rousseau, that the self is conceived of primarily in terms of inner feelings. If you think about being born, say, in the Middle Ages, if I'd bumped into you in the Middle Ages and I'd have said, "Who are you?" you would probably have told me, "I'm the son of such and such a person. I live in such and such a village. I hold this particular rank in society." All of your markers for identity would be external ones. Today, I might say to you, "Who are you?" And you might say, "Well, I'm straight," or "I'm gay." You might say, "Well, actually, I'm an extrovert," or "I'm actually a depressive." When you think about those terms, they're move inward terms. They're terms that talk about our psyche, our psychology, not our external placement in society. And that also comes with the transformation in the way we understand society to relate to the individual. In the Middle Ages, what's the game? What's the game of life? The game of life is to find your place in society and then adapt yourself to fit into it. Today, the game seems to be increasingly, I am who I am, and society must accommodate itself to affirm me as who I am. So that's really the psychologization of the self.
We're talking with Dr. Carl Truman of Grove City College and author of the book The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self about the origins of the sexual revolution. How do Rousseau's ideas form a foundation for the ideas and the thinkers that follow him, like Friedrich Nietzsche?
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
Jesus said, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." This is Monica Shannon, Life Coordinator for the Southern Illinois District Advocates for Life. We invite you to join your brothers and sisters in Christ for a peaceful, life-affirming prayer vigil from 10 to 11, Saturday morning, March 20th, at Planned Parenthood in Fairview Heights, Illinois. For more information, visit sidadvocatesforlife.com. sidadvocatesforlife.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Carl Trubin is our guest, professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College and author of several books, including his latest, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. We're talking about the origins of the sexual revolution. So, Dr. Trubin, how did Rousseau's ideas form the foundation for the ideas of subsequent thinkers like Friedrich Nietzsche?
Well, there's both continuity and discontinuity. On the one hand, Rousseau's discovery of the inner space as extremely important sets up the play for later philosophy to be thinking about human beings in terms of what drives them is that inner space. What saves Rousseau from a kind of complete moral subjectivism is his belief that human nature does transcend the individual, that it has a moral structure, that if you, Todd, and I both discover that inner voice of nature, guess what? The voice will be saying the same thing. It'll be telling us to be empathetic to our fellow men, to other men and women. There is a moral structure of human nature. What Nietzsche does is he sort of accepts that the most important thing about us is that inner space. It's our experiences, it's our feelings, it's our desires, it's our passions. What he denies, though, is that there is any such thing as human nature that has a moral structure to it. And therefore, what we're left with, if you like, is the naked will or the bare will. We can create our own moralities. We can create ourselves. We can be whomever we want to be by force of will. So the path from Rousseau to Nietzsche is, as I say, it's one both of continuity and discontinuity. Once you have that Rousseauian inner space detached from any notion that human nature carries with it moral obligations or a moral sense, then really the floodgates of the modern self are opened at that point.
Nietzsche's view is, from our perspective, very dark and pessimistic. Does anyone else pick up Rousseau and kind of keep the optimistic notion that he seemed to, or at least the vestiges that he seemed to have?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that if you look at modern society today, we might say that human beings tend to fall into three categories. There are the traditionally religious, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Roman Catholics, conservative Jewish, etc., etc. And then there are, we might say, that the other side, there are atheists. But I think atheists divide into two camps. On the one hand, we have the Nietzschean atheists, the hedonists, the ones who want to transgress, the ones who want to create themselves, the ones who find the purpose of life in living for the moment, in the exhilaration of the moment. But you also have a kind of humanists, and I would say a Richard Dawkins or a Steven Pinker. They're kind of Rousseauian in that they've moved dramatically towards, they deny the existence of God, they've gone beyond Rousseau. But they seem to believe that at root, human beings are decent and good and empathetic and altruistic. And if we can just rid ourselves of religion, rid ourselves of certain elements of society that corrupt us, human beings will flourish and be good. So I would say, in the kind of modern Richard Dawkins, optimistic, humanistic kind of movement, we find the true heirs of Rousseau.
So how do Nietzsche, Karl Marx, and Charles Darwin, how do they strip away the foundation of human identity and morality?
It's a good question. And they do it in three different ways, but three ways that have come, I think, to permeate the modern way of thinking. Nietzsche does it by really calling the bluff on the Enlightenment. And Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, is the man he has in his crosshairs. Kant doesn't think we can really know anything about God, but we need to assume the existence of God in order to provide the universe with moral stability. And I think Nietzsche, and I'm with Nietzsche on this level, Nietzsche says you can't do that. If you get rid of God, if you kill God, as he puts it, then you get rid of everything that rests upon God. You can't say that we have to assume God in order to keep the moral stability of the universe. Why do we need to keep the moral stability of the universe? Get rid of God and everything is plunged into chaos. Marx comes at it in a slightly different way. Marx, really following, building on Hegel, but spinning Hegel in a sort of economic materialist way, says, you know, there's no such thing as human nature as something that has a consistent moral structure. In actual fact, human nature is something that's undergoing historical process. And so today's morality merely serves the economic interests of the dominant class. And therefore, we can't really talk about transcendent morality. Morality has to be dismantled because morality is just a way of disguising the selfish interests of the dominant class. So Marx, too, gets rid of the idea of human nature having a fixed moral structure. And Darwin does it scientifically. Darwin says, you know, human beings, we're just highly evolved apes. Morality is simply those practices enshrined in beliefs that tend to help the flourishing of the species. We think certain things are wrong simply because they serve the evolutionary interests of our species. But we can't talk about a transcendent moral structure to human nature. So all three of them in their different ways essentially abolish the idea that you and I are in some way accountable to our human nature in a way that would lead us to behave in certain moral ways.
What do you mean by the sexualizing of the self?
Well, again, when you think about, okay, we've got Rousseau, and Rousseau psychologizes the self. Rousseau is the man who says that inner space is the most important thing about you. What then happens, and the man most responsible for this is Sigmund Freud, late 19th, early 20th century psychoanalyst. Freud agrees with Rousseau. He says, yeah, your inner feelings, your inner desires, they are the most important things about you, but guess what? They're not altruistic. The voice of nature is not about empathy. The voice of nature is dark and characterized by deep, violent sexual desires. And Freud is the man who really says that's what defines us as human beings. It's our sexual desires. And that's a critical move because, you know, if you look at the Bible, how does the Bible treat sex? The Bible treats sex as an activity. Some sexual activities are considered legitimate. Some sexual activities are considered illegitimate. Today, we don't think of sex primarily as an activity. We think of it as an identity. Sex isn't something you do so much as something you are, such that you could claim to be, I'm a gay man or I'm a straight man, even if you've never had any sexual experience or encounter. That sentence makes sense. Why? Because we've accepted Freud's basic point that inner space is actually a sexual space. And it's sexual desire that defines who you are as a self.
So is Freud, in essence, the sea change in thinking that takes these ideas that have been fomenting before him and gives them a trajectory toward the sexual revolution?
Yes, I think Freud is critical. I mean, you, without Rousseau and company, you couldn't have Freud. But Freud definitely tilts things towards the sexual frame that we now see life through. And he does it, of course, in the cool idiom of scientific language, which is a very, very plausible way of talking in the late 19th and then on into the 20th century. Scientific experts are the priesthood that carry huge authority. So when Freud says, you know, we're sexual beings, that's an incredibly plausible statement for a man like Freud to make.
Was, in a sense, already Western society primed for Freud to make this, at the time, rather scandalous suggestion?
Yes, in many ways. And I think Freud is right on this level, that sexual desire is a very powerful component of what it means to be a human being. We know that sexual codes and transgression of sexual codes have played a very important role in society throughout history. You go back to Rome, Greece, there's pornography. We know that sex is not just something we've invented in the last 100 years of something that's of interest, but actually does touch on something very, very deep and powerful in what it means to be a human being. And Freud is really, when he says we're sexual beings, he's saying something that human beings find plausible, and indeed human beings want to hear. So I would say Freud is definitely tilting society in a direction that society is prone to tilt anyway.
How do Freud's ideas lead to the politicizing of sex that we see rampant today?
Well, in some ways, it's obvious that once you define the self in terms of sexuality, sexuality has to become political, because politics is about the organization of society, and society is really about how selves, individual selves, coordinate and organize themselves into a coherent whole. So once the self is sexualized, sex is going to get political. This particular path it takes is really through the New Left, particularly a thinker such as Wilhelm Reich, a one-time junior collaborator of Freud's, but somebody that Freud himself came to regard as too extreme. Reich is the man who says, you know, human beings are sexual, and political oppression, therefore, has to be seen in large part in terms of sexual repression. Society oppresses people through its sexual codes, and therefore, the dismantling of those sexual codes, the dismantling of the prohibitions against extramarital sex, homosexuality, etc. If we're going to have political freedom, we have to dismantle those things. Now, very few people today have read Wilhelm Reich, but his ideas have come to permeate the political imagination such that we now think, you know, if we're going to be happy as a society, we have to allow people to be able to act on their sexual desires.
So I'm curious why Freud found Reich too extreme when, from my perspective, on the other side of the events, it looks like the next logical step for Freud to have taken.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It actually comes down to Reich's particular emphases. Reich was particularly focused upon orgasms of all things. And Freud found Reich's sort of monomaniacal focus on that issue to be far too extreme a way of reading the sexuality and the sexualization of human beings. And Reich also started to drift off, though I think this was probably after Freud. Reich himself was clearly also a little bit mad. He started to drift off into UFO conspiracy theories towards the end of his life. And actually, odd historical fact, died in prison in the state of Pennsylvania, where I'm speaking from right now, charged with fraud for designing and trying to sell a sex machine. So Reich was a very strange personality in a lot of ways.
I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're discussing the origins of the sexual revolution with Dr. Carl Truman, author of the new book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. If you live in the greater Denver area, please be sure to stop by Ad Crusum's new store and office next week. The grand opening is on Tuesday, February the 23rd at 6657 West Ottawa Avenue in Littleton, Colorado. Ad Crusum is a Christian greeting card, jewelry, art, gift, and housewares company for church and home. Find out more at adcrusum.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com. When we come back, what do we mean when we talk about the triumph of the erotic?
Do you sometimes struggle with getting family devotions started and keeping them going? Do you sometimes not know what to say or how to say it? Well, in the most recent issue of The Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Dr. James Bonnick talks about family devotions and how these are formative for the life of Christians and how you can keep them going in your own home. To order your copy of The Lutheran Witness, visit cph.org/witness or visit our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Are you looking to use your Thrivent funds to beautify your church? Never fear, Ad Crusum has the solution. See our liturgical banners, baptismal or confirmation certificates, gifts, Christ-focused greeting cards, and posters. Alternatively, stock up on a set of Christmons or Christmas ornaments. Visit adcrusum.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump Drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
This is Pastor Philip Hauser with Lamb of God Lutheran Church in Papillion, Nebraska. We're faithful to the Lutheran confessions as recorded in the Book of Concord, and our services are traditional Eucharistic liturgies in accordance with the ancient texts Saturday evening and Sunday morning. If you're ever in Omaha, come visit us. We're on Lincoln Street between 84th and 96th in Papillion. Our website is lambofgodlcms.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor. Bethlehem Lutheran, Fairborn, Ohio. Faith Lutheran, Plano, Texas. Grace Lutheran, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Emmanuel Lutheran, Osceola, Iowa. Mount Olive Lutheran, Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Snohomish, Washington. St. Mark Lutheran, Waco, Texas. St. Timothy Lutheran, Dayton, Ohio. And Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.
There's just very, very few examples of using this technology in a way that honors every child's right to life and every child's right to a mother and father. Sometimes the most ethical thing for adults to do is not satisfy a want. We cannot look at the problem of infertility and make children pay the price for it.
Hume says no miracle has been attested by credible witnesses. And his proof of this is that if someone does believe in a miracle, then that person is no longer credible.
If Disney wanted to actually take a real principled stand for properly understanding how we should view the Holocaust, they would stand up to the people who are doing a Holocaust right now. And they're not.
Wait a second. You're discriminating against me. I have chosen an alternative economic lifestyle. If I want to rob banks, I want to rob banks.
Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week will be live Friday afternoon, February the 19th. You can listen to this week's contestants in advance on the Talk On Demand archives page at issuesetc.org or on your podcast feed. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us a tweet at issuesetc, an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or wait and give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. That's Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week, Friday afternoon, the 19th of February at 4:30 Central. We're talking with Dr. Carl Truman about the origins of the sexual revolution. Dr. Truman, what do you mean when you talk about the triumph of the erotic?
Again, that sort of connects with what we've been talking about. The triumph of the erotic is the way that sex and sex-related themes have come to permeate our culture, such that when you read the statistics on Internet use, a vast amount of the Internet, of Internet use, is now taken up with accessing a pornographic sites. Pornography is a huge multi-billion-dollar industry, I think, in the United States. TV programs that 30 years ago would have been regarded as pornographic are now mainstream, scenes are mainstream. So I think it's the way that sex has become such a dominant theme in our public life, in terms of entertainment, culture, and politics. That's the triumph of the erotic.
Why was the U.S. Supreme Court Obergefell decision so important?
I think it was important in a number of ways. It changes the legal landscape in terms of potential future religious freedom issues, given the prohibitions which traditional Christians place on homosexuality. I think it reflected the fact that the culture in the United States has changed dramatically, even in the last 10, 15 years, in terms of its attitude towards sexual behavior, particularly sexual behavior that's traditionally been considered illegitimate or inappropriate. It sort of confirmed, it didn't start this, but it kind of confirmed the process that was begun with the advent of no-fault divorce in California in 1970, of transforming marriage from being a lifelong bond between two people of the opposite sex, only to be dissolved in the most extreme of circumstances, death, adultery, desertion, into a sentimental bond between two people for the convenience and happiness of those two. So it also fundamentally, I think, reinforced, consolidated, solidified a basic redefinition of marriage that had been taking place in Western society for some 45 years before that.
How has the revolution of selfhood built a culture of protest, especially on college campuses?
Once the self becomes psychologized, the whole notion of what is and is not aggressive and offensive and oppressive changes. You know, when you think of Thomas Jefferson, when he's thinking about religious freedom, and he says, you know, what does it matter whether my neighbor believes in no God, one God, or 20 gods? It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. Jefferson's notion of selfhood is very much an economic one, and if you're not harming his money or doing physical damage to him, then everything's fine. You're free to behave in any way you want. Once you think of the self in terms of psychology, then anything that hurts me psychologically becomes damaging, a weapon. Now, when you think of religious freedom and freedom of speech, well, what are religious freedom and freedom of speech? They're the freedom to believe and to say things that other people find hurtful and offensive. When you're in a world where being psychologically hurt is a major issue, when you're in the world of the psychological self, then freedom of speech and freedom of religion become not so much solutions as they become problems. And that's why campuses today, where we have a generation of young people growing up who assume that harm can be thought of in psychological terms, are finding great difficulty with the idea of freedom of speech and freedom of religion.
Why has the T in LGBTQ+ emerged as the dominant force and so quickly in our culture and politics?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the reason is that we have so bought into the idea that our inner feelings fundamentally define who we are. We have so disregarded the significance of the body in the way we think about ourselves that society simply doesn't have in its toolkit any way to offer fundamental objections to transgenderism. Once you've bought the idea that, well, people can be happy in any way they want, and the important element of happiness is how you feel inside, it becomes very, very hard to challenge somebody who says, you know, I've been born in the wrong body. I am unhappy because there's a me inside this inappropriate body that needs to find an expression for itself. It's very, very hard to object to that.
Regarding the church, you say that we Christians are Christian in a very different way than Christians were Christians 500 years ago. What do you mean by that?
Well, 500 years ago, there wasn't any choice, really. I mean, by and large, the medieval peasant was born, baptized, got married, and buried in the same church. There were no religious options. Not being religious was not really an option because it would have meant that you were placed on the outskirts of society. Today, religion is one option among many. And when you think about the way most of us think about the world, even as Christians, you know, if I woke up tomorrow morning and suddenly didn't believe in God, much of my life, my relation with friends and neighbors, would carry on much the same. Whereas in the Middle Ages, if you suddenly decided you didn't believe in God, that would have a dramatic impact on how you related to the world. So the difference between now and then is religion now is a choice, and it's often a hard choice. That's not an entirely bad thing. The New Testament really presents Christianity as something that you're meant to commit to. There is an existential urgency there that was not there, I don't think, in the late Middle Ages. But it does mean that our experience of religion today, experience of religion as an option, is not one that would have been experienced in the Middle Ages.
So how can the church respond to what you have called expressive individualism?
It's a tough one, partly because the church has to realize that we as Christians are complicit in this. This is the world we live in. We choose to be Christians today, humanly speaking. We choose to be the type of Christians we are. A Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox person may turn around and say, yeah, well, I was baptized. I've always been in the church. To which I would respond, yeah, but these days you have the option of leaving the church. You choose to honor your baptismal vows. You choose to stay. So I think the first thing the church needs to do is acknowledge that we're complicit in this world of expressive individualism, that we ourselves can tend to treat religion as a consumer choice that meets our psychological needs. Secondly, I think we need to realize that the way to if you like, to win in the world of expressive individualism is to provide a strong community to which people can belong. We need to be the church. In the world in which we live now, people's identities are, generally speaking, the function of the communities in which they belong. And the strongest identity is the function of the strongest community to which they belong. I think the church needs to focus on being a true community in order to really provide its people with a strong anchor identity that allows them to navigate the world that they face Monday to Friday.
Dr. Truman, you say that we live in a Reefian anti-culture. What is that?
This is a term coined by Philip Reef, the American sociologist, late professor of the University of Pennsylvania. Reef makes a comment on modern culture. He says, if you look back through history, generally speaking, the role of the elites in society has been to transmit to the next generation the values, the behaviors, the practices, the institutions of the culture. He said, the interesting thing about modern culture is that the elites, the teachers, the politicians, etc., the artists, the intellectuals, they no longer see their role as communicating the values and practices and beliefs of the previous generation. They see their role as destroying, critiquing, overthrowing those values. And he says, that isn't a culture. That's an anti-culture. That's a culture that is built on negation. It's not a culture that's built upon positive constructing on the past. It's a culture built on the overthrowing, the destruction of the past. And that, he says, is what characterizes the modern world in which we live.
And you say that Christians are complicit in this anti-culture. How so?
I think we can be. I mean, sometimes when you think about our attitude to worship, maybe not so much now, but certainly 10, 15 years ago, the idea in a lot of churches was, you know, if you were singing a song that was even 2 or 3 years old, you are out of date, man. And the whole, we need the liturgical form of the church need to be constantly reinvented. In fact, Christians need to understand, you know, we stand on the shoulders of our theological ancestors. We need to build theologically and liturgically always on the past. And that means we need to stand pretty firm against the cultural intuitions of the present that are, I would say, profoundly iconoclastic.
Dr. Carl Truman is our guest. We're talking about the origins of the sexual revolution. If his thesis is correct, that the sexual revolution is only a symptom of a much greater, older revolution of selfhood, what's the implication for Christians?
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
When it comes to serving their neighborhood, what could two churches 2,400 miles apart have in common? Both Grace Lutheran Church in Blaine, Washington, and Christ the King in Memphis, Tennessee, are confronting homelessness in amazing ways. Their stories are inspiring and make you want to join in with them. Hello, my name is Rahema Kavuga of Lutheran Church Extension Fund, and I'm inviting you to check out these stories and more at interesttime.org. Great things are happening coast to coast, and you can be a part of it. That's interesttime.org.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues, Etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues, Etc. podcast weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues, Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. LutherAcademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/LutherAcademy.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Wednesday, February the 17th, we're talking about the origins of the sexual revolution with Dr. Carl Truman, author of the new book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. So for Christians, Dr. Truman, what are the implications of your thesis, namely that the sexual revolution, the LGBTQ movement, they're only symptoms of a much greater and older revolution of selfhood?
Well, again, that goes back really to the answer I gave a few moments ago, and to say that we need to realize that we can't separate the sexual revolution from this general revolution in the self, what I call expressive individualism, this prioritizing of our inner feelings. And you know, again, to sort of repeat the answer to that, I think that the way Christians need to respond to this is we need to acknowledge it, and we need to build strong, disciplined communities that, to the extent that we are able to swim against the tide, enable us to do that.
The temptation, of course, is to try and beat a revolution at its own game and to thereby accept the premises of that revolution. Do we need to think hard about explicit ways to reject the premises that have been put in place for the last almost 300 years?
Yes. I mean, it's hard to do. But again, communities can do that. Communities can cultivate intuitions and way of thinking that run counter to the broader culture. And I would also say, and I've said this a few times elsewhere, you know, Christians, particularly in America, we tend to think of it as a culture war that we're engaged in. I think thinking about the church not so much as an army engaged in war, as a community engaged in protest, might be a helpful way to go about it. Wars tend to be engaged by armies that are using the same collection of weapons. Protest, you can be a protest simply by exhibiting in the way you live your life a very different way to the lives of the people around you. So again, to go back to that point about the church's community, if the church builds itself as a community on very, very different moral frameworks, beliefs, and intuitions to the world around, the church can be an example of protest within the culture as we currently find it.
Is that going to be possible in what many have called kind of generic big box Protestantism, where at least it appears to me this expressive individualism has become the message of the church?
Yeah, I am very skeptical as to whether the seeker-sensitive / mega-church model can really work in this kind of culture in which we have. You know, I go back to, it was actually then Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, in the late 60s, talking about the Catholic Church, he said, you know, the church has got to get smaller because it's got to become a more clearly defined, tight-knit community. I think tight-knit community, that's hard in big-box churches. It's hard with generic, bland Protestantism. It's almost impossible with seeker-sensitive Protestantism that, in its very evangelistic premise, has essentially conceded lethal ground to the wider culture.
You spoke earlier about how society has essentially abandoned the tools with which to respond to many of these ideas. Is the same true, then, of a major sector of the American church?
Could well be. I think the health, wealth, and happiness gospel is one example of that. I think many of us, when we examine our own hearts, know that there's more of wanting to be made happy by the churches we go to, perhaps on a Sunday, than we would like to admit. So yes, I do think that both corporately and at an individual level, we are all prone to tilt in that therapeutic direction that lies at the heart of many of the current pathologies of our contemporary culture.
Near the close of your new book, you speculate about some of the possible futures for this revolution we've been discussing. What are they?
Well, they're difficult to tell. I mean, I think on one level, transhumanism could be the next step beyond transgenderism. The melding of human beings with machines is something that people are sort of talking about. Whether it'll ever be possible, I don't know. But just because something's impossible doesn't mean that it won't be tried and a lot of damage won't be done in the effort. I'm relatively optimistic that transgenderism may well prove, in the medium to long run, a step too far. There are hopeful signs, even in the way it's being reined back in my own homeland, the United Kingdom. The trans lobby is beginning to get some pushback now, culturally. Could well be that transgenderism falls because in 20, 30 years' time, kids whose parents use them as chemistry sets, sue their parents, sue the doctors who prescribed the hormone treatment or performed the operations, and sue the insurance companies who funded it. And hey, this is America. As soon as big corporations start to lose money on something, they're going to change their attitude to it. I think that gay marriage is probably here to stay. I don't think that that is going to fall anytime soon. So I think that the future is open as it stands, but you know, it could go in a number of different directions.
Why is it vital that Protestants recover what, in to a large degree, Roman Catholics and perhaps the Orthodox have never abandoned, and that is natural law and especially a high view of our physical bodies?
Yeah, I think that the Protestants have not done a good job in seeing the, what might I call, the moral structure of nature. And one of the things I've noticed with kids at Grove, where I teach, good Christian kids, you know, they'll ask you, is homosexuality right or wrong? Homosexuality wrong? I say, yeah. To which they'll say, well, why? Well, the Bible says so. And that is a decisive argument on one level. But I know that at the back of their minds, they're thinking, because of the culture they live in, well, why does the Bible say that? Is it because God is an arbitrary tyrant who doesn't want people to be happy or to flourish? At which point, I think, you know, I can introduce arguments from nature and say, you know, male and female bodies, they're meant to fit together in certain ways. Look at the statistics for those who engage in homosexual sex, men who engage in homosexual sex. Look at the integrity of the body. Look at how nature has certain checks and balances built into it that should steer us towards thinking of human flourishing in certain ways and having a certain shape. And that, I think, is a simple way in which natural theology and the theology of the body can be helpful. Not as a decisive standalone arguments within the church, but as helpful supporting arguments, encouraging Christians to realize that what the Bible says actually makes sense. And I think those arguments, natural law arguments, maybe not in quite that form, but natural law arguments can be deployed in the public square as well in order to show different ways of thinking about the current climate. I mean, when somebody says, I've been born in the wrong body, you know, asking, so, well, why, when somebody says, I'm born in the wrong body, do we automatically assume that the body is wrong and the mind is okay? You know, that's an interesting question, I think, to push back with in these times. So I think that a recovery of an understanding of the moral structure of nature can be a great help to Protestants at this particular point in time.
You conclude by a brief reflection on Christians in the second century. In what kind of a situation did they find themselves, and what can we learn from them?
Well, in some ways, their situation was different to ours because they were living in a world that had never been Christian. It was a pagan world. It had never known Christianity. Our world is a world that has known Christianity and is increasingly rejecting it. But in other ways, they're quite similar to us. They were considered to be a marginal sect by the dominant culture. They were considered to be immoral. They were considered to be seditious and as incompatible with the common civic good. So there are a lot of similarities in the way they were regarded than the way we are now regarded. How did they respond? Well, they responded in the kind of way I described earlier. They became a tight-knit community. They worked as good citizens to the extent that their Christian faith allowed them to be good citizens. If you want them to fight in the Roman army, they would do it. If you want them to bow down and worship Caesar, well, they're not going to do that. There are limits. But to the extent that they are able to, they demonstrated their loyalty to the Commonwealth, and they demonstrated that they were a powerful and loving community. And that takes me back to my notion of the church's protest. I think we need to see our current impending marginalization. On the one hand, yeah, lament it. It's unfortunate. It's going to be uncomfortable and unpleasant. But let's not terminate with lamentation. Let's also see it as a potential opportunity for building something good and strong for the future.
Dr. Carl Truman is professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College. He's author of several books, including his latest, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. When you purchase this book at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Talk On Demand Archives, and look for The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Dr. Carl Truman. Dr. Truman, thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
Thursday on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Albert Moeller about Christian nationalism. We'll continue our series, The New Testament Manuscripts, discussing Jesus and other written sources with Dr. Craig Evans. And we'll respond to your email and the Issues Etc. comment line. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.